Welcome everybody, this is the first philosophy talk of the year, so a great pleasure.
This is your honour.
It's a great honour to welcome Giuseppe Bianco from the University of Warwick, who is a very important figure and a great expert on particularly French philosophy of a particularly the unaccustomed kind. He's written some wonderful things on Bergson, as I know, and in particular he's been devoting himself to the work of Jean Hippolyte, who is perhaps not known to that many of you, but a very famous French Hegelian and Hegel scholar from the middle of the 20th century. And Giuseppe's been working on Hippolyte and his archives and questions to do with structuralism in France, and all sorts of important things. And recently he published a book on Badiou and the philosophers, I think, which transcribed and translated a number of interviews between Badiou and a lot of important contemporary French figures. He studied in Paris and at the Jan van Eyck Academy in Maastricht, where we first met, I think. And yeah, and without that much further ado, because we're a bit late, I'm sorry about that, let me introduce his talk. It's called Verbose Dialectics and the Anthropological Circle, Michel Foucault and Jean Hippolyte. Yes,
okay, thanks very much, Mike. Thanks, everyone. It's an honor to be here. And I apologize for the delay, because it's completely my fault. I was on the wrong campus, and then I was calling him and realized, because I was asking everyone, where is the philosophy department? No one knew. So finally I'm here, and once again it's a real pleasure. Thanks for the introduction. I don't know if I'm important or whatever, but as Mike was saying, yeah, I kind of work in general in 20th century French philosophy, in the perspective of this in between history, philosophy, sociology, and history tout court, let's say. So I'm trying to make a little bit a step back from the traditional history of philosophy, even if this paper is very traditional in a way. So I, as he said as well, I work on figures that are known or that are important for a few reasons, because they were masters of older important philosophers. Hippolyte is an example, Jean Val or other figures, and also like archives and, let's say, unknown texts in the perspective which is the one of history of philosophy, more than of militant philosophy, if I can allow myself to describe that. I gave you, there are some handouts, so it gives you a little bit already the idea of how I'm working. So you have like the two columns, which is what is called a prosopography, so it's like a parallel description of the life or the works of two intellectuals, in this case Jean-Paulie and Michel Foucault. And then you have other four columns, and you will understand yourself what it's all about, and will give you a kind of guide to what I'm going to tell you about Hippolyte. And all this paper came out a little bit out of the research that I was doing in Hippolyte archives, and I was trying to understand to what extent Hippolyte had been influencing not only Foucault but all his pupils, like several generations of French philosophy. And I found some letters to Hippolyte by Foucault, so I was trying to construct a narrative to understand to what extent this whole old Hegelian influenced the first, especially the first books by Foucault. So I will start a little bit like with some episodes. The first one is when Jean Hippolyte was the director of the École Normale until the beginning of the 60s, got elected as a professor of the Collège de France, and at that moment he received a lot of congratulatory letters from his students and his colleagues, and there's a letter as well from Foucault. And in this letter, Foucault says to Hippolyte, and he explains his importance as a model for all generation of philosophers, And for himself, he writes to Hippolyte. This letter is not yet unpublished. Probably been going to publish a lot of materials because the situation, let's say the rights of the papers of the old papers of Foucault are going to be transferred to the Bibliothèque Nationale. So you're going to have a lot of unpublished texts that will emerge. But this letter is in the in Hippolyte archive. So Foucault says to Hippolyte that he was the sole philosophical model that he had. And this more or less the same thing is reaffirmed in the course of the address that Foucault gave in honor of Hippolyte Diacolorma when he died in 69. And even in the first lesson that he gave at the Collège de France himself in the 70s called The Order of the Discourse, that probably some of you know. And Foucault says that all the philosophical problems that his generation had found to be solved had been posed by Hippolyte for the first time in 53 in his book Logic and Existence, that had been translated in English in the 90s and the 80s by Len Lawler and another friend of his. So in this book, Hippolyte was the first one to pose to state those problems for the first time. Problems that the pupils, as Foucault himself was, had to solve. The story of the relationship between Foucault and Hippolyte is long because he was the director of Foucault. Let's say translated in the with the English expression would be MA dissertation of Foucault from the 40s is called Diplôme d'études supérieures of Foucault on Hegel. And then when Foucault was teaching at the École Normale, Hippolyte was there being the director. And then they had been in close contact during the years. There's another episode, like a letter that is also in the Hippolyte archives from 63, in which Foucault says to Hippolyte, he relates to an episode concerning his main thesis, which was the history of madness. And he says to Hippolyte, "I shook my head the day you told me that my book was Hegelian, but in truth I was moved. That which is philosophical in it was yours, and out of a text you had no doubt find not to recognize this." So in this sentence you clearly see that there's a kind of a bowel of a real philosophical depth to Hippolyte. So what I'm going to try to do in the following, let's say, 40-35 minutes is to understand to what extent the first works of Hippolyte had been Hippolytian in a way, and what could be as well the Hegelian heritage or the Hegelianism contained in Foucault's thesis, History of Madness, a work of which Hippolyte was no doubt an attentive reader, because Hippolyte was supposed to be the supervisor of this work, and finally he passed the Foucault to Canguilhem. So I'm going to divide this paper in three parts. First of all, I will take a look at the situation of Hippolyte's works and philosophy during the 50s to understand the important limitation and the influence of Heidegger and Hippolyte's philosophy during the 50s. Then I will consecrate some time to analyze two lectures given by Hippolyte during the 50s, where you see the influence that he was exercising, in my opinion, to Foucault. And then we'll come back in the last part to the history of madness to understand to what extent this book, in my opinion, was influenced by Hippolyte. So first, kind of mise en contexte, contextualization of Hippolyte and the philosophical field in France during the 50s. And what is striking is that during the 40s, I would say, the philosophical field is dominated, I would say, by a kind of obsessive interrogation about the relation between man and history. And there's a shift that Ansel Rabinbach described as a textual event at the beginning of the 50s. There's a shift of this kind of pattern or paradigm in French philosophy, which is constituted by the publication of the Letter on Humanism by Heidegger, that had been first translated into French in the late 40s, and then the complete translation came out during the 50s. So the principal consequences, probably some of you already know of this text, is that it consists of the kind of dissolution of the confidence of French philosophy in man, and let's say as well a kind of determined complete mutation in the humanist interpretations of Marx and Hegel that dominated the philosophy of Courbet, Sartre, and Merleau-Ponty. And some Hippolyte, as a lot of his contemporaries, was struck by this text and other texts of what will later be called the second Heidegger. So he consecrated a lot of lectures to a close reading of Heidegger, as others, as for example this other very important French philosopher, Henri Biro, or Beaufret, or others that play this role of translators and introducers of the second Heidegger. So during the 50s, basically he's saying in several lectures that he stated like clearly that Heidegger is the greatest contemporary philosopher, and he does this kind of comparison between the phenomenology of the spirit and the logic on the one hand, and on the other hand the Zeit by Heidegger and the second Heideggerian philosophy on the other hand, to say that as the phenomenology of the spirit is just an introduction to the logic, is the same for Heidegger, the Zeit is just the introduction to the later philosophy, and Heidegger, he's the one who's posing the new problems in a new in a new way. He is the one, I quote Hippolyte, to open a new problematic of being, a problematic that permitted one to go to the things itself and go further than Husserl and Bergson, that he treats as simple positivist. It's a very strange use of the term, but as he poses the question. So this Heideggerian influence is most perceivable in probably in his most important book after the first reading of he published, let's say, two very important readings of interpretations of Hegel. Structural Genesis of the Phenomenology of the Spirit is 46, and 52, Logic and Existence, that is more focused on the logic. Maybe this is once again the most important book by Hippolyte, the one who influenced the whole generation of thinkers such as Derrida, Deleuze, Foucault, and so on. And so it is in Logic and Existence that it's more perceivable, this Heideggerian way of posing problems. In Logic and Existence, Hippolyte's interpretation of ego is no longer centered upon understanding the human subject as the source of negation, as for instance it was the interpretation of Courbet, but on the study of the development of the dialectic being, a development that is to be interpreted as that of sense coming to its realization in absolute knowledge. So he changes the focus, and in this shift, what is sacrificed in a way is the, once again, the central position that man as a source of negation had in the historical process. So in the problem is that in this problematic relation that he draws between logic and existence, between logic and phenomenology, is once again existence that he is sacrificed. In order to understand the logic, the very idea of the subject and of man arrives in a very interesting way, Hippolyte has to be reduced, placed in parentheses. So Hippolyte will invoke such a kind of epoche on several occasions, and he came. He was the first one to use this expression, and later influenced Derrida. This idea of a transcendental field without a subject. And his colleague and friend Georges Canguilhem will say later, when he died, that one of Jean-Hippolyte's merits in French philosophy is that he had made French philosophy lose consciousness, I quote Canguilhem, lose consciousness of what it had, you know, regarded as consciousness. So the importance of Hippolyte, once again, is introducing this anti-humanism through Heidegger in Hegel. So logical existence is a kind of really a cut in the history of French philosophy. It ends the series of humanist interpretation of both Hegel and Marx. In a way, if you think of Louis Althusser's writings starting from the early 60s, you can see as well in this idea of history as a process without subject the influence of this interpretation, anti-humanist interpretation of Hegel and Marx by Hippolyte. So let's come back. So this is like what happened in Hippolyte's reflection and production at the beginning of the 50s, in 52, and it lasts during the 50s and the 60s until his death. So let's look at, on the other hand, what happened in the intellectual itinerary of Foucault. Foucault in 50 is, of course, 20 years younger than Hippolyte. In 52, after having obtained a diplome in psychology and a diplome in philosophy, is delivering a series of lectures on psychology at the University of Lille and at the École Normale, invited by basically by Louis Althusser. And since 48, the one who will later become the author of For Marx, had been an active teacher and a militant communist philosopher. He had been a promoter of a Georges Pulitzer circle, whose objective was the one of bringing together students of the École Normale with cadres and intellectuals of the Communist Party. And at this precise moment, so the late 40s, the ideological line of the French Communist Party is going through a hardening and a slight change that was involving the condemnation of existentialism, of psychoanalysis, generalized Dadaism, and a lot of attacks against all the intellectuals who were not categorized as communist or Marxist intellectuals. And behind, let's say, the main reason of those attacks was the, say, all those attacks were aiming at denouncing the alienating, mystificatory, and so anti-human, as the communist philosophers were saying, anti-humanist character of bourgeois ideology. And those texts were opposing to this bourgeois philosophy, the only humanist philosophy, which was the one of Marx and dialectical materialism. So Foucault, that was inspired in the French Communist Party until 51. In 51, he leaves the party, but he still keeps a tie with Althusser. He's still defining himself as a communist, even as a Nietzschean communist. So at this moment, his position is very ironic, and so it's also the way in which I'm working. I'm not trying to find a coherence in the position of intellectual in certain periods. So in this period, for instance, Foucault is writing a foreword to dream an existence that was a work of existential, of the existential and phenomenologist Ludwig Diesmann de Guerre. But on the other hand, he was also working on authors such as Pavlov and on Marx. So at the same moment as I was introducing at the beginning, there are a lot of encounters going on between Hippolyte and Foucault. While Foucault was pursuing his apprenticeship in psychology at the Sainte Anne Hospital, Hippolyte was participating in the same place to the seminar of Lacan, and was also attending Henri Baroux, who was a Alienist consultation at Charenton Asylum. So at this time, Hippolyte is as well interested in psychoanalysis, in psychiatry, and he publishes a lot of texts. I'm talking at this moment, at the beginning of the 50s, a lot of texts about psychoanalysis. And so one of these texts, called Psychanalyse et Philosophie, is very striking. It's very important to understand the later the change of Foucault's philosophy during the 50s. So in this text, Hippolyte begins by situating existentialism in relation to psychoanalysis, and he highlights the interest of the psychoanalytical explication of the concrete man given by Sartre and Bislanger. As I was saying, at the same moment Foucault was writing on Bislanger. But immediately following this humanist, let's say, opening, Hippolyte invites his readers to go further, to go beyond anthropology, which is always, he says, unsatisfactory. In this way, the crucial question is not longer the Kantian question, what is man, but the Heideggerian question, what is being. So once again, you see clearly how, to what extent, the influence of the second philosophy of Heidegger was having on his reflection on alienation and on psychoanalysis in general. And you can find the same movement in another text of the same year, 55-56, called Pathologie mentale et organisation. It's a strange title that could be translated as mental pathology and organization, but basically it's a text about what is to be alienated. So setting out from his experience as a philosopher at the Asylum in Charenton, he relates his experience, and he says to what extent he's convinced that, I quote Hippolyte, the study of madness, alienation, the profound sense of return, lies at the center of an anthropology. Visiting this asylum, this place which is, I quote again Hippolyte, the refuge of those who can no longer live in our interhuman milieu, allows the philosopher to analyze the separation between the mad and the normal, and through the latter to illustrate the question of mental alienation which arises for the man said to be normal. You already perceive a little bit to what extent those attractions were the same, or the same problems were affecting the young Foucault, that did not publish it, of course, did not publish at that time the History of Madness. So Hippolyte concludes that mental alienation is not simply the result of a failure in the relation of man to his milieu. It's not simply that I'm mad because I'm not, my relation with the world, with the other people, is not working. It proceeds as well from a failure in the relation of the design to being. So the problem has to be situated, according to Hippolyte, between anthropology and ontology. So the two articles, or the two, actually they were talks at the beginning, the two articles that I referred, Pathologie mentale et organisation, and the other one, Philosophy and Psychoanalysis, analysis has to be put into relationship once again to the development of core reflection and production during the 50s. And especially it has to be in relation with the existentialist text Introduction to Dream and Existence of Bismarck, and to the Marxist long text Maladie Mentale et Personnalité. Both are from one is from 55 as far as I remember, the other one is from 54. So the same moment in which Hippolyte was giving those lectures. So in the preface to the first of those texts, the introduction to Dream and Existence, Foucault announces his wish to, I quote Foucault, to situate existential analysis within the more general development of contemporary reflection upon man, and to show by observing the inflection of phenomenology toward anthropology what grounds had been proposed for concrete reflection on man. So at this point, his project is not very clear, in my opinion. It seems to belong to this kind of transitional phase in Foucault's thought. In the same preface to the work of Bismarck, Dream and Existence, Foucault writes that the dividing line, I quote him again, between Dasein and Menschsein, between ontology and anthropology, appears difficult to trace, and he avows that the ontological conditions of existence create problems, declaring in a prophetic tone the intention to put them aside for another time in which he will approach them. So he says, okay, it's too complicated, I will do it later. At the same precise moment, he published this other text, Maladie mentale et personnalité, so human disease, mental disease and personality, a work that, on the other hand, I was saying that his position was very ironic, work, on the other hand, was very strongly marked by a version of Marxism conforming to the humanist, to the humanism of the French Communist Party. So the objective of this book is to confront the representation of mental illness belonging to scientific knowledge with, I quote Foucault, a reflection on man himself and with the relation historically situated of man to the man who is mad and the man who is true. So basically, once again, the project, which is influenced by this teleological and anthropological version of Marxism proposed by the Communist Party during the late 40s, the beginning of the 50s, is to inscribe the concept of disease, the concept of mental illness inside this narration about what is an alienated man and to what extent the social conditions and a precise moment of history is influencing the let's say the mental disease of the state. So this model of psychology is taken up by this psychologist and French philosopher called Georges Polizère, that was dear both to the early Althusser and to Merleau-Ponty, that was once again internalizing this humanist interpretation of Marxist philosophy applied to psychology. However, this Marxian interpretation of madness given by Foucault in this text is completely abandoned. The second version of the book, dating from 62, so just 1 year after the history of madness, called Mental Illness and Psychology, and in Folie et Déraison, which will later become the history of madness. And in both those two texts, the humanist and Marx is displaced and substituted by a kind of Heideggerian anti-humanist Nietzsche. So Foucault summarizes the evolution of his intellectual trajectory in several interviews from the 70s. In which he explains that after having studied Hegel,
then he moved from Marx to Heidegger and then discovered Nietzsche. So this is kind of a very brief summary that he gives much later in time during the 70s, and at the same time tries to hit the reality of what happened and the unconscious, let's say. So in Mental Illness and Psychology, so which is the second version of the book of the 50s, published in the early 60s, Foucault substitutes the study, I quote, of the real social condition of illness for a reflection on psychopathology, I quote again Foucault, as a fact of civilization. The chapter 5 of this book no longer questions, I quote Foucault, the historical meaning of alienation, but the historical constitution of mental illness. Chapter 6 abandons the psychology of conflict, finally, human dialectics, for an understanding of madness as an overall structure. So this Marxian myth of an unalienated human essence is replaced by, I quote Foucault, the representation of a definite relation of man to himself, which precedes all his historical experiences and relativizes them in measuring them by his own fundamental truth. So in those two works of 61 and 62, Foucault moves from an anthropological question concerning mental illness to an ontological question concerning madness. In the conclusion of Mental Illness and Psychology, there takes shape an interpretation of history as a process of concealment of truth, whose inspiration is clearly Heideggerian, even if Foucault doesn't say a word about that. If there is no psychological truth of madness, it is because madness itself, in its essential and timeless truth, rends history with its lightning flashes. So one of those lightning flashes, as Hippolyte had indicated in his text from the 30s, from the 50s, is Nietzsche, who appears alongside Bataille, Arthur, Van Gogh, and Strindberg in the final chapter of The History of Madness, entitled precisely The Anthropological Survey. Here Foucault underlines, I quote him, the coherence of an anthropological thought that runs permanently underneath the diversity of scientific formulation which accompanies the analysis of the phenomena of mental illness. More broadly, in the history of madness, history ceases to be presented, as it was in his text from the 50s, Maladie Mentale et Personnalité, as a process of resolving contradiction, and notably of the contradiction which produces mental alienation. On the contrary, the history of madness is but the repetition of the same gesture of exclusion of madness from the space of the logos, which is language, history, culture, humanity. As Foucault clearly spells in the preface to The History of Madness, insofar, I quote Foucault, insofar as madness is a dull sound and a murmur without any speaking subject and without an interlocutor, and thus an unable and unhuman phenomenon, it constitutes the condition of possibility, or the transcendental, of human history conceived as the plenitude of meaning. So this mutation of the reflection of Foucault during the 50s is confirmed in a way by a letter that he addressed Hippolyte from Uppsala, where he was working for the French Centre de Culture, Cultural Centre, more or less. So it's a letter from 56 that I found in the archives, and here Foucault writes to Hippolyte that in Sweden there is much talk of Hippolyte, of the occult, and of the death of God, and he ends this letter with the hope that Hippolyte might return and talk more about the death of God. In fact, on the invitation of Foucault himself, Hippolyte gave a series of lectures in Sweden in the summer of 56. For instance, the lecture History an existent Islamic existence delivered in, at Uppsala, Hippolyte had retraced the adventure of French reflection about, upon history since existentialism, the concept of existence, of Dasein or being there, refers, according to Hippolyte, to the concept of situation and even to that of historical situation, while the problem of the sense of the historical situation refers in turn to the problem of the general sense of history. And as the other lectures of Hippolyte from that moment, this lecture as well ends with two observations. The first concerns the difference between the position taken by Sartre and Merleau-Ponty in relation to communism during the 50s. There were a lot of debates concerning to what extent one should or should not support the French Communist Party and what the Soviets were doing in Eastern Europe. And the second point, that is the one that interests me, aimed at opening another problem. And this problem aimed to relate French existential philosophy to the new aspects of Heideggerian philosophy. Thus, Hippolyte sought to distance himself from his two colleagues, Merleau-Ponty and Sartre. All existentialists, he said, remain humanists insofar as they conceive history as the history of man and not the history of being. And then I quote Hippolyte again, only Heidegger comes to enlarge the problem in taking into consideration a temporality which is no longer properly historical, because men are dismissed from their roles as actors. So this history, bracket in a way, because it's not history as we conceive it, is nothing other than, I quote Hippolyte, the unveiling of being which operates through them in a certain temporality. The liberty of man will be less his own adventure than the adventure of being through man. So as a consequence, the anthropological questioning of man by man must be subordinated to a more fundamental questioning of being by man. This latter questioning must, in the last instance, be understood as the discourse of being itself, a discourse of being creating itself in history, not thanks to man, but despite him. So I come to my last point concerning history of man as itself, and to what extent this book could be seen as a Hippolytean book, as Foucault was stating in his letter to Hippolyte. So I come to the second part of the title of my paper, which is the verbose dialectics. So this epistemological recasting also affects the concept of alienation, which Foucault has used abundantly until 54. The use of this concept, central to Hegel and Marx, is grounding upon the following postulate, just to be very simple, even naive. There exists a human identity or essence that can serve as a standard against which the degree of man's dispossession or alienation can be judged. Moreover, this concept constitutes the core of our philosophy of history, which in containing a historical residue in the concept of man remains anthropocentric. So this category, the category of alienation, is forcefully dismissed in the history of madness, notably in the chapter entitled The Anthropological Circle, in which, in a kind of coup de théâtre, Nietzsche, which was absent in the book, appears. Foucault produces a genealogy of the anthropological apparatus which has structured knowledge of man, including psychiatry and psychology, since the 18th century. This apparatus hangs upon a notion of alienation which Foucault does not hesitate to characterize as mythological. So he used until 54-55 the notion of alienation, then 7 years later he says it's just mythological. This notion of alienation both involves and produces truly alienating practices. To put it more accurately, it is these practices as well as the institutions which deploy them that allow the mythological concept of alienation to be constituted. So in the serious institutional asylum space, a priori of the medical perception, proof of the human being, a series that Foucault describes throughout like 100 pages, so we'll not go through. So it's this series that makes possible the formation of this very concept of alienation, which constitutes a fundamental element of the anthropological apparatus. The Foucault's history of the emergence of the concept of alienation borrows as well Hegelian figures in a surprising manner. So I come to the reason why this strange history, Heideggerian history of madness that implies as well a critique of the notion of alienation has a series of Hegelian features. And in particular, this history is guided by the development of the unhappy consciousness found in the phenomenology of spirit, and particularly on Hippolyte's interpretation of the latter in his famous Genesis and Structure of Hegel's Phenomenology of Spirit that I mentioned at the beginning, text from 46. So I gave you this handout just to as a kind of guide or a map. So the unhappy consciousness, according to Hegel and according to the reading of Hegel given by Hippolyte, is a double consciousness because it interiorized the opposition between master and slave. It is the split, or rather the hesitation, between purely contingent determination and immutable certainty of self. In the final stage of the unhappy consciousness, the singular consciousness wants to alienate its particular will in order to be nothing but the universal which it locates in God. This alienation, which is concretized in an impossible and guilty ascetic will, remains deprived of all means of dialectical overcoming, and so consciousness does not cease to humiliate itself in registering its exile within being, the impossibility of escaping its singularity. So basically, unhappy consciousness is the fact of being thrown apart, not being able to overcome singularity and rejoin universality, just to explain it in a very brief way. In the phenomenology of the spirit, this figure of the unhappy consciousness is surpassed by that of reason, which is universal self-consciousness, identical to being itself, the first figure of spirit prior to its objectification in history. So these are the two figures used by Hippolyte in Genesis and Structure to introduce a judgment upon French philosophers as a whole. So the text is from 46, and he used Hegel in the short passage to criticize or to describe the situation of French philosophers. I quote Hippolyte: "French philosophers generally prefer the unhappy consciousness to spirit. They take up Hegel's description of self-certainty, which fails to be in self, but which nonetheless exists only through its transcendence toward then in itself. But they abandon Hegel when, according to him, specific self-consciousness, subjectivity, becomes universal self-consciousness, a movement through which being is posed as subject and subject is posed as being." So, end quote. Sorry, it's the prose of Hippolyte on Hegel translated into English, so of course it looks kind of obscure. So basically, for Hippolyte, French philosophy had found itself entangled in a repetition of the dialectic without overcoming the unhappy consciousness. But for Foucault, who was using the same figure, and who was a very attentive reader of Genesis and Structure, according to Foucault, the anthropological apparatus animated by the verbose movement of alienation, or I quote Foucault, or by the verbose engagement of the dialectic, is to be returned to the perspective of an incomplete dialectic turning in circles, I quote Foucault again, becoming involved in the game of incessant resumption, adjustment between the subject and the object, between the inside and the outside, between lived experience and knowledge. So Foucault, as Hippolyte, uses this figure of the unhappy consciousness, but instead of limiting its scope, as Hegel does, to the moment of the birth of the church in the Middle Ages, or instead of limiting its scope to an interpretation of French philosophy of the 40s, Foucault, he makes of it the figure of all modernity, a modernity read through the history of madness, because it's in the history of madness we're talking right here. So this figure guides Foucault's analysis of the birth of psychiatry. In his analysis, we find the salient points of the Hegelian description of the unhappy consciousness, a consciousness which alienates its will to that of another, which faces the guilt of not managing to do so completely, and which becomes an object for itself. I will not go through the point into the detailed analysis to show you to what extent these three stages are present in the history of madness. But I will just conclude saying that given this figure of the unhappy consciousness characterizing modernity and especially the history of psychiatry, psychology, and psychiatry institution, it remains, according to Foucault, impossible to conceive an overcoming such as the one defended by Hegel. The Hegelian overcoming, insofar as it is dialectical, can only bring us back to the figure of the unhappy consciousness. The overcoming of the unhappy consciousness by this kind of verbose dialectic, as he puts it, can only lead us to another divided consciousness, to another unhappy consciousness. This overcoming without real overcoming, I would say, to which Foucault refers at the end of the History of Madness, corresponds to nothing less than the very disappearance of the anthropological apparatus itself, to the erasure of the figure of man, to the death, I would say, of the normal man, and to the end of all verbose dialectics. And this is what is more or less announced in a tone which is prophetic and very Heideggerian, but no less explicit and black and white, in the final chapter of The Order of Things, book published in 1966, precisely entitled The Anthropological Circle. So this is my prophetic, there's no prophecy, conclusion, and thanks everyone for your attention.
Somehow, I think
Foucault moved from Hegel to Heidegger.
Yeah.
And I just wondered, I mean, Heidegger is more of a Kantian figure than Hegelian one. If he had anything to say about Kant's anthropology and the role that plays.
Yeah, it's a very good question, and it actually touches, I would say, the second part of the paper, which was not the paper at the beginning, was this kind of very long or huge magma with a lot of different elements. So the beginning of the paper was supposed to treat, because I'm working, let's put it like this, let's enter from this entrance. I'm working more between contemporaries than between great philosophers in the abstract time of the great history of thought. So I'm always working between, let's say, pupils and teachers, colleagues, and on the other hand, also adding this kind of sociological Bourdieusian approach. So the other figure, so you have Althusser, you have Hippolyte, for sure, and the other figure, which is not very, this guy is not at all very famous, who during the 60s and 70s worked basically on analytical philosophy and history of maths and arithmetics, called Jules Guillemin. And Jules Guillemin was also the one that allowed Foucault to teach at Lille University. Althusser was the one that allowed himself to teach at the École Normale. And to come to the point, because I've been coming to the point, so Guillemin wrote a book in 54 that I marked in here, Heidegger in French, called L'Héritage Kantien et la Révolution Copernicienne, so the Kantian Heritage and Copernican Revolution, which is a book that precedes the moment in which he's going to write more about epistemology, history of science, etc., etc. It's more a book about history of philosophy, and he's putting, he's presenting a series of interpretations of Kant during the 19th and 20th centuries. So you have, as far as I remember, first chapter on Fichte, second one on Cohen, that I absolutely don't know, this philosopher, and then the third one is the one of Heidegger. So the Kant that was published much earlier, but whose translation had been published in France in 1953. And the book was very, very influential for a series of philosophers that then will completely disavow any Heideggerian heritage, but who read books. So not only Foucault, that probably read had on the right the Heidegger text translated into French, and on the left had this book by Guillemin, L'Héritage Kantien, but also, for instance, influenced as well Deleuze, who in 56-57 gave at high school a series of lessons called Qu'est-ce que fonder? What is to ground? What is the meaning of grounding? That had been analyzed by Christian Terblake in English lately. And in this text, there's a problematization, of course, of Kantian philosophy, and it's a book that, all together with a letter on humanism and a series of little texts that had been translated during the 50s, had influenced French philosophy. So of course, the idea of Heidegger in this book, the whole Kantian philosophy could be resumed in the question, what is man? This way of posing or interpreting Kant's philosophy as an anthropology influenced the approach to Kant during the 50s and beginning of the 60s. So I don't know if I've answered your question. So how Kant is fitting into this broader picture is because or is through, once again, Heidegger, but not only through Heidegger, but through the translations of Heidegger and through a series of books and essays by French philosophers on this book and on Heidegger itself. Then there's another guy who publishes a series of articles on Kant and Heidegger, who's Dufresne at the beginning of the 50s, and there are a lot of colleagues and friends of Deleuze that were saying that at the beginning of the 50s actually Deleuze was reading the book first in German, trying to read it in German, but he wasn't a Germanist, so he was not able to read it properly, and then in the translation. So really it was a very very important book that Hippolyte is not mentioned, by the way, not in the text on Hegel, nor in the essays that he wrote on other problems such as existentialism and psychoanalysis, what's mental disease and all.
I'm interested in
the
fact that
you
come back,
right?
Sure.
Without any precise memorization, and Foucault comes back to those problems much later during the 70s and the 80s before his death. So you have these prophetic phrases about the fact that the man, the figure of man, will disappear as a writing on the sand, etc. So it's kind of unsolved problem of both, let's say, on a philosophical point of view in this moment, and probably on the ethical political point of view, because also the position of Foucault in the middle of the 60s is kind of ambiguous. He's not anymore engaged or following the ideological line of the PCF, but nor is following another line. So it's kind of very open. And of course, the question of man and humanism is the central for many reasons, starting from the end of the Second World War, the reconstruction of France, and then the beginning of the 50s, and it deals with the line of the Communist Party, it deals with the de-Stalinization, as you pointed very well, and it deals as well with the way in which Soviets were behaving in the Eastern European countries. There are a lot of problems dealing with that, and probably deals also with this idea of that we are coming more or less, we are going towards the end of history, and the situation in Eastern Europe and destabilization was a proof. There's no proof in history, but it was a kind of proof that history was not closed. So there's no genealogy. So the story is still open, and how to give account of the fact that the story is not open if teleology is tied to the centrality of the subject, and humanism, etc., etc. At least in from this perspective, it's a problematic or upright point that Foucault, Deleuze, Derrida, each one has solved in a different diffracting point of view, or following a diffracting line. Basically. Thanks.
Any other questions? I have one. No. Would it be unfair to ask about Lacan? Because I've wondered what Hippolyte got from Lacan attending these seminars. And given that Hippolyte has such an influence on Derrida, Deleuze, and Foucault, as you said, I'm not quite sure what Lacan fed into that history. And because it seems to me that, you know, Lacan was a bit of a blind spot for Derrida and for Foucault to some extent. And it strikes me that somehow the way, I mean, maybe Hippolyte just sat in on the seminars and didn't agree with Lacan, but there's a sense in which the psychoanalysis is a Lacanian kind. You could say that what psychoanalysis does presuppose an essence of man in the way that it seems like Foucault and people want to overcome. And I was just wondering, I was trying to think in my head, what is alienation in Lacan, what is madness, and what is the source of negation? Because you have a nice way of expressing this move from humanist readings of Marx and Hegel to ontological ones, which is that in the humanist version, the source of negation is the human being, and later on it's not. And I was just trying to work out, I was trying to remember what Lacan would say about that, and because we have the subject of the negativity within being, and that sort of a void in the structure. And it just struck me, there's a nice thinking about I love G-Death and so on, and there's another Hegelian heritage coming out of Lacan to understand the relation between subject and structure and a relation of negation and something else. And I wonder if you had any, I know some do you have any thoughts about what Lacan is doing, what work is doing?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know, I mean, I'm I'm not Lacanian, Lacan scholar, as I'm not anyone scholar. So I know a little bit of
talk. I'm sorry for asking.
No. But, let's say that once again, to combat always the my boring approach to the question. So, the idea that finally an author doesn't have an interiority, an author is not identical to himself. There's this nice text by Bourdieu called a short text that I always suggest everyone to read, which is called The Autobiographical Illusion. And he says biography is not working. It's more or less crap. Because biography is the attempt to describe a metro tube line from the perspective of the train. So you just put it in front and just look and you move slide. You cannot understand it. So what you have to take into account is the different position in which the train is located in the broader map, and considering also how the time is passing by. So this is more me adding this diachronical element that is implicit in Bourdieu's approach to the analysis of sociology of knowledge. So to come back to Lacan as well, I'm not saying that Lacan is other anti-Lacanian, saying he was just a prankster. But Lacan was always trying to situate himself in different way according to the limitation of the philosophical, psychoanalytical field, and so he's adding theory a little bit, and everyone, we all do that. We steal a little bit from other people. This is other book, which is very nice, called Penser avec la bouche pleine, which is would be translated How to Think with the Mouth Full. So you always have mouth full of other people's words, other people's concepts. So Lacan was working as everyone a little bit like this. So so you can formalize that as our friend Lorenzo Chiesa has done in Subjective Ordinance. So you have the first Lacan, which is more the imaginary, then you have the second Lacan, which is the symbolic, and then you have the third one, which is the real. And it makes sense in a way, but this is, let's say, the effect or the phenomenon of other movements. So to come back to the point, finally, the Lacan of the 30s and the 40s, that absolutely Lacan doesn't have anything to do, or a little bit to do with the Lacan of the of after 56, after Jean, I don't remember the title.
The field and function.
You know better than me. So the Lacan of structuralism, the Lacan who is applying the instruments of linguistic structuralism to psychoanalysis. So there's a shift. And this shift is not only affecting the contents of Lacan, but also the perception of Lacan itself. So Lacan is perceived as Lacan after 56, when he does this shift and he begins publishing his journal called La Psychanalyse, that puts himself puts him in the chessboard of French philosophy and French human sciences, and even more after 66, when the writings of Lacan had been gathered. So Lacan at that moment he becomes a real author. Before he was not really an author, he just published some essays. So until that moment, he was strongly influenced by the guy that I mentioned like a few times, one or two times. Georges Politesse was like a Marxist philosopher, influenced by Gestalt, influenced by a little bit by phenomenology, who had a very humanist, to put it very bluntly in a simple way, interpretation of phenomenology, of psychoanalysis, who completely evacuated psychoanalysis from the unconscious. According to Politesse, we don't care about the unconscious. The unconscious is a realist leftover of scientific psychology of the end of the 19th century. So he was really influential for Merleau-Ponty itself and Lacan himself. So I guess without responding to your question, I don't know to what extent Lacan was reading already Hegel, because he wasn't fine as well by Kogel, so probably there was a trace of this reflection, but probably until the beginning of the 50s, he was already, he still had this idea of, let's say, anthropocentric reading of psychoanalysis, that finally the aim of psychoanalysis as well inserted into a broader sociological and economical analysis of society. You can read that in the essays from the 30s by Lacan. Then you can de-alienate someone and come back to health, let's say. But then this thing is falling apart in the 50s. And Lacan as well was the one who published in his journal, La Psychanalyse, in the middle of the 50s, the translation of Logos by Jean Beaufret. So Heidegger was very influential as well. And I don't know, just this episode about Jean Beaufret, one, as I said, one of the main introducers of the second Heidegger into France, that was one of the patients, or analyzed, I don't know, of Lacan, and probably Lacan was sleeping all the time, was not feeling happy about what this guy was telling, and a lot of psychoanalysts do. And then he woke up when Beaufret said, like, yeah, and by the way, Heidegger would like to see you. And he woke up, because of course Heidegger in that precise moment was super influential. And all the questions of the late 40s about is Heidegger a Nazi or not was not the question to ask about him. It was more, what is this guy doing? And it allows ourselves to go beyond phenomenology, beyond Gestalt, beyond human Marxism. So, and when he's giving his seminar at the Saint-Anne Hospital during the 53-55, you know better the dates, and the police is going there. Of course, there's something going on, but I'll not be able to describe what are the precise movements of stealing, passing concepts. It's more like it's you get the feeling, because it had been published in the first issue of the journal Psychanalysis in 56, those two essays, the one by Vermeulen, employed by Hegel, and the kind of response by Lacan. And what you see at work is a kind of attempt on both the sides of psychoanalysts on one hand to appropriate the language and to explain philosophy on the other hand. The other movement. One thing on the conceptual level, it's the moment in which Lacan is shifting or is moving, taking a step aside from this humanist interpretation of both Freud and, but mainly Freud, inspired by Baudelaire, inspired by Debye, inspired by other people that wrote on Freud and. 30s and the late 20s in France. So,
thank you. Do you want to
turn
that
off? Well, let me just say, I mean, you can enormously throw a detailed answer to my question. And all I can say is that even at the point of lack of writing in the early stage, and at that point, you managed to hear people destroyed when you were trying to form your own relative life about the Freudian reconstruction of your identity that becomes biologistic and psychological. And even at the point of the literature suggestion, you say you can't read the Eastern Scholars in the way in which a lot of the Freudian theory of reading is you when the little child was very soon to tell the story, you find it's not all the time, you find it's back. It's at that point of entry in language. The creed is the church in the biological realm. at the point when Michel Debs entered London, that he got a place, he got a team for Stephen Crosser, the evil combat in terms of social and linguistic cultural construction.
Yeah.
We've got to see the pieces as a ballot.
Yeah.
It's not a simple ballot.
Yeah, you're right.
Tool, it's a symbol.
Yeah.
And so even at that stage,
yeah.
You have a very, and all the things that came along,
yeah, probably. Yeah, probably it's more problematic. Yeah, I see your point. I see, totally see.
So my thought was that there is a slightly more recent reading of Lacan, which suggests that if you're going to think about a subject being alienated by these symbolic structures into which he's forced, well, what is that thing which is being put into these symbolic structures? My thought was that if alienation is going to be explained by the imposition of structure upon subject, well, doesn't that imply that there is some pre-symbolic, pre-structural essence to man which is being alienated? And that was my point there. That there must be, there's a way, that's why it's a bit funny that Lacan enters into anybody's itinerary at all, because,
yeah.
Because there is a kind of, at least at a certain stage, there is a kind of, that's the humanism I meant in Lacan, there is a human essence prior to structure, prior to
Your relic as well.
Send it to me later.